My dad has a Defender Can-Am.
I would go with the new 1500s.
Yeah.
I used a straight bone stock one. Absolutely bone stock. I used Josh's all last week with my kid.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
I've always had good luck with
full HVAC too. Polaris full. Too. The Can-Ams don't have full HVAC.
Hmm.
The Polaris's do. Full HVAC. Like, just like a fucking Tundra.
Brady and I were halfway up a mountain last week committing to this spot, and he had to stop and like confirm, is Go Hunt gonna pay for me to get these scratches buffed out? Because we're either turning around or we're committing if we're gonna foot the bill for Brady's new paint job.
And you have a diesel that'd be easy to pull.
Yeah, it'd be so easy. I was pulling Gabe's side by side after my four-wheeler broke on my Nevada deer hunt, and I was still getting 14 and a half, and that was going Omar's directing us right now. And that was still going like 75 miles an hour. And if I backed it down to like slower, I was getting way better.
Yeah.
But going, you know, the speed limit
it's
a little
beautiful above. Thing about a diesel. I actually really like what you got.
Yeah.
The
I think it's perfect for majority of stuff.
Smaller and then size and pull.
Yeah. Because majority of the time I don't have a trailer to pull. And then when I pull, it still gets pretty good mileage. And
that's a sweet little truck.
So you thought I had bad scratches before. You should see them now.
We were like leaning.
Did you commit to Go Hunt paying for that?
He did I say.
Did, yeah.
Thanks, man. Thanks for setting
service,
me up.
So I was just like, I really want to get up there. Don't have service to verify. So I'm going to say yes.
Thanks for signing me up. I'll co-sign on that right now.
We got there. That was our most successful hunt.
Actually, you know what? I'm not going to because it didn't lead to success. So.
Define success.
We made good memories.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And we found out where there's not elk.
Just as important as finding where there is elk.
Yep. So we know going forward where to go.
Okay.
Welcome, Lane.
Thank you. It's been a while.
It's been a while since I've hung out with you. we just got back. We talked a little bit on last week's about our adventure. And now we're talking about scratches right now. And you just like made me shiver again thinking about the scratches.
I was like, when we were driving up the road, you've had those roads where like everything's growing in.
Oh yeah. It becomes a tunnel.
Yeah. And you can hear it on the sides of the road. I was like leaning, thinking it would help. I was like leaning away from the bushes, thinking it was going to help not scratch the truck. And every time it would get like one of those good, really high pitched ones, Brady and I would just both kind of like cringe. Like, oh, there better be elk up there.
Does everyone do that? I swear. Yes, like you hear scratches, I was like, oh,
you're absolutely.
Just, it's like you're getting hurt yourself. You're just like, you just can't help but like make a noise when your vehicle's getting all scratched up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then you get those really loud squeakers. You're like, whoo.
That can't be good.
You're like, that one got through the protective coating.
The hard part is too, though, is like you have the mirrors. And so eventually I folded in the mirrors, but they're still getting scratched and they're plastic. Yeah. So like those scratches are forever scratches.
Have you guys ever heard of PPF? It's like a new big thing. Paint protection film.
Huh.
It's supposedly, but it's expensive is the only problem.
I think
my brother-in-law told me about it, this PPF stuff. And it's like, it defends against all everything. And it's just a film. It's like a clear wrap, essentially, is how my brother-in-law explained it to me. I don't know. Somebody can tell me if that's wrong, but that's how it was explained to me. And it's like impenetrable. So it defends your paint against everything. I'm like, shit, that's perfect for hunting.
Perfect.
I need to look into that. Crazy expensive. But apparently it just, you just take that film off and your paint underneath.
I think I saw something about that from like Australia. It was called like bush wraps. Someone was talking about it in some truck form and I was like, that's sweet to look into. But then I saw it was Australia and I'm like, oh, how do I get here?
It's a huge thing in the vehicle world. Now it's this PPF stuff.
Interesting.
Like rock dings and you know, all this stuff like normal wear and tear on the nicer vehicles people are wanting to protect. Like, shit, that actually would be great for hunting.
That would.
Little above the hunting budget.
Yeah.
I'm right in the transition. I have a 5-year-old truck. I'm right in that transition from like clean it all the time, keep it clean, like no food in the truck. I'm right going into that like, okay, there's dog hair, spilled coffee. You know, how it's like a slow turning the corner, but I can feel myself being
just
less,
not caring.
Just less diligent than I used to be.
Yeah. Have you seen my hunting track?
No.
The one out front?
Oh, you're the white one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Dude,
I haven't been inside that.
I used to really care about that car. I used to really care. This Nevada hunt season, I'm full. I've turned the page. I don't give a shit now.
I'm still at the stage.
I destroyed that thing in the desert. Destroyed it.
Desert is hard on rigs.
It's so hard.
So hard on rigs.
The thing's, it's done now. I've turned the corner. So now I just don't care.
Did you notice in the back of my truck, I still have like blankets and towels everywhere? Yeah. Like I'm trying to protect the leather. The
that's going to be Brady forever.
You need to get seat covers.
I know. I was looking at seat covers, but like some of them are just so ugly. I understand I can take them on, put them off. That's why I'll probably get some ugly ones.
And just I found leave a them brand. Season. I found a brand. Hmm. Camo and you might not like it because their logo is an elk.
Ugh. Yeah, I can't have that in my truck.
But I love it because they're low. But you can change. You can change what it is. Covers and camo. They're out of Utah, I believe.
Let's look them up right now.
I found them, and they do all kinds of seat covers.
Okay, yeah, those are actually pretty good.
And you can
those look good.
And you can like put what you want in there. You can put the, you know, if you want them camo, if you want them, I don't know.
Oh, they have like alligator print.
Like for like alligator, ostrich.
There you go.
You can pick all this crazy stuff.
Huh, interesting.
That's what I need to be more serious about that. Because that's what gets destroyed more than anything is your leather, like setting stuff on it.
Yeah.
And rubbing and all, you know.
So here's a great point we'll talk about on our go hunt pants. Okay, so I was wearing a non-go hunt pant because I have a ton of hunting pants. But there's a pant I was wearing that had a back pocket, like where you put your wallet, and it was zippered.
Rub the shit out of it.
It almost put a giant cut, like not a cut, but like, you know, one of those like wear, like you take your fingernail and like
you
scratch
can
your
see
leather
where it was rubbing in.
Yeah. Just like hopping in my truck and you know, scoot over. Yeah. I was like, that's the dumbest thing ever, putting like an actual external zipper on a hunting pant on the back pocket because you're sitting in your truck so much and you're bouncing around. So
and that's
like,
why we didn't do it. Mm-hmm, thoughts right are these there. Things.
That's right.
Shut up.
But we also need to get seat covers.
We're going to talk mule deer. On this podcast, Lane's going to a certain state. Maybe he can say the state, but we're going to talk about late season Montana deer hunting strategies.
Okay.
Your tactics for late season bucks.
Okay. I don't know if I would give them as advice. They would be more of like, here's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. What are you going to try to do in this hunt? So describe what you're going to do.
Well, going home, Thanksgiving. I feel like, first of all, if I just pay attention to like the people that I know from there, like 90% of the deer get killed the week of Thanksgiving in Montana, whether it's driving around the breaks, whether it's road hawking them in Western Montana or whatever. So the time is now. It's been unseasonably warm everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere.
Until right now.
Yes. But there as well. So my brother's been texting me like, oh, it's going deer hunting. It's going to be 48 degrees today. Like, hope they're rutting. So that doesn't do you many favors, but
it's coming now though.
It is
like,
coming.
I don't know
now.
If you guys noticed, we got snow in the mountains.
It is coming now.
Which is early for us.
Yeah.
Like there's snow in all these mountains around
Vegas,
right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's early.
I can see it on my run this morning.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that we can kind of make up for some lost time here. Like if it's been hot and if they've been kind of dogging it, maybe the last week will just be bonkers if you get some cold weather, some snow, push them out of some places.
You going whitetail or mule deer?
Well, it kind of depends on where we're seeing success, but we have tentative plans. There's an area we always hunt that in the late season gets too much snow to actually, like Thanksgiving time gets too much snow. So that might not be the case this year, but we're trying to have, we have a little backup plan where we've just been studying this area on maps for so long that we're like, where do these things go? If they're going to come out of here, when it snows, like where will they go? And we found like what we're pretty confident is where they're going to go. And there's some big bucks in there.
Nice.
So that's going to be the plan. I would like to shoot a mule deer. I haven't shot a mountain buck in a while now, like 8 or 10 years.
In Montana?
In Montana.
Wow.
I've been going out to Eastern Montana and doing that whole game. So I really want to shoot a mountain buck this year. So we're going to commit to that kind of, I really want to just test some theories. You know,
okay.
Like sometimes hunting for me is just going out and hiking my ass off and glassing and seeing if like you can find something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited to go into this with like a theory that I want to either prove or disprove.
Yeah, for sure.
To me, that's like part of what hunting is becoming, is like less about whether you get something and more about like the mental exercise of figuring these things out.
Yeah.
Like a lot of whitetail hunters embrace that maybe
That's a good way to put that. Like building theories and then testing them is kind of what hunting becomes as you get later in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think if we figure it out, it would be more rewarding than like stumbling into something.
For sure.
Which I'm also okay with.
It always feels so much better when you put a plan together and you're like, I knew it. Yeah. See, mm-hmm. I knew this.
Like we outsmarted these things. So I'd like to try that. But we also have a handful of areas that would like to go rattle if the mule deer thing isn't working out.
I've seen some really good whitetail get put down so far. That's why I was asking.
Yeah.
There's a few guys I've seen put down some stellar whitetail.
Yes. So, that's like kind of there's so much thick timber around Missoula. You guys both lived there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we might do if the mule deer thing isn't working out is we got a couple of areas where, you know, it's like you can get into these not huge, but good size, like basins where we think there might be some whitetails, rattle for a while. If you don't see anything, pick up, go to the next one, pick up to the next one. And if it's cold, if it's warm, I think that might be kind of a done by midday. But if it's like, sometimes you get those bitter cold days and that you could do that all day.
Yeah.
That would be,
it'll lead to something.
It'll lead to something. Yeah. So that's the game plan. Have a little turkey, watch the Grizz beat the Cats this weekend.
Hell yeah.
That's kind of my plan for the next week and a half. I hope so.
I don't know about definite, but I hope so.
You gotta manifest things.
Yeah, true.
You have to manifest things. It's in the Grizz house. So
we've been on a slide against the Cats though for a bit.
Yeah.
And what's crazy is we all
when we were there, it was guaranteed.
Yeah.
Now been on a slide.
I think it's 2-3 this year.
Is that what it is?
I think the Grizz are 2, Cats are 3. So
how long have we been on a slide losing to them?
I think they've won like 6 of the last 10.
Yeah.
So they've definitely, but like I think we went to the Natty 2 years ago. The Cats went to the Natty last year. Both of them lost, so it's kind of like tying for second place, but
First loser.
But it should be a good game.
Is it a prerequisite at Go Hunt? You have to work, or you have to go to school at University of Montana to work here?
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. It's the best education system. It's, you know,
Harvard of the Northwest.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the Harvard of the Northwest.
We have three of us here. We had Luke at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And Mather.
Mather makes also. Our films.
Yep.
I think that's it, right?
We have zero Bobcats in this house.
Good.
Yeah.
It's good zero.
Thing. Yeah.
Just keep it that way.
Just Grizz blood, baby.
Before we get any deeper, though, we have some house notes to go through.
Housekeeping.
Here. Housekeeping notes. Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. I have two cups of coffee here and haven't finished either of them, so I need to keep going.
That's a problem.
Yeah. For those listening, again, we have our postseason roundup here at Go Hunt coming Thursday, December 11th at our Vegas showroom. So if you're in the area, mark your calendar, stop in, food, drinks. A good old time, talk some hunting stories, hang out. It's free to enter. You just got to jump into the RSVP link and come hang out. Bunch of raffle prizes. We're going to donate all the proceeds from the raffle to a conservation organization. So if you're listening to this, we're going to drop a social post eventually and ask which conservation group we should donate all the raffle proceeds to. So tune for that. Giving away
Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl. Something like that, you know?
Oh, those ducks stuff?
Okay. Yeah. I have two things to say on the there's two goals of the postseason roundup. One of them is just to have a great time, which is inevitable. Mm-hmm. We did that last year. But what I was proud of last year, and I want to even do better this year, is the ratio between people buying raffle tickets to the, like, cool stuff we give away.
Yeah.
I want that to be, like, a staple. We were giving away... And the super generous by a bunch of our partners too, but like Swarovski's, SIGs, we gave away bows. There was like 100 people there, 100, maybe 150. So the ratio of like amazing prizes to your odds of winning them
were great.
Yeah.
And I want it to be bigger this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be.
It will be bigger. Yeah. But it was a good time last year. Really super looking forward to it this year.
Yeah. So if you're going to be in town, that's the same week as NFR and all that stuff, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Yep.
So if you're going to be here, for NFR, all that Rock Mountain Elk Foundation, Hunter Christmas type thing. Stop Come over Thursday, December 11th.
Come say hi.
At like 5 o'clock roughly till who knows when we're going to close it down. So come hang out.
Mm-hmm.
Will Black Friday still be going on?
Yes.
When this podcast goes out next week?
Black Friday will be the next day.
Okay. So yeah, we have our updated promo code. So use promo code podcast sign for inside. You're going to get $100 back to the Go Hunt Gear Shop. Normally promo code is going to give you 50. So great chance to get more money to turn around, buy some gifts for yourself, buy some gifts for your family members with that $100 back to the gun gear shop.
Best gifts over the holidays is the ones you buy yourself.
Yeah. And hunters, everyone knows, are the worst to buy gifts for.
It's a guarantee your best gift is going to be the one you buy yourself.
Yeah.
And you get $100 and then everything's on sale.
Yeah.
So you buy it cheap. Like, it's an infinite.
Talk about compounding value here.
It's an infinite hunting gear loop.
Infinite.
Yep. So, if you don't have an insider account yet, you should get one before this coming application season. Start planning and researching all your hunt plans. And then if you're interested in our Insider Plus, which is our handheld service where you can go through, make your own plans with one of the guys in the office here and walk you through all your applications. We'll apply for you, help you e-scout, do everything for you. You're going to get $200 back. So pretty sweet deal there.
It's perfect timing.
Yep.
Start of next app season already.
And is there any other notes we need to cover for that or anything else? What's going on here at Go Hunt?
No, I don't think so. There's a lot going on, but I'm not sure we have time to talk about it all in the promo read.
Yeah. It's a lot of cool things coming. And we just dropped our Alaska application overview. I heard we're going to have updated draw odds here pretty quickly for all the states. I know we're going to probably drop Alaska maybe first, because obviously it's one of the first ones at December 15th deadline.
Yep. They're trying to get all the draw odds, or almost all of them, by 1st of December this year.
Okay.
Which would be the earliest we've ever done it.
Yep. Give you plenty of time to research Wyoming, research Arizona.
All of December when you're just waiting for Christmas and seasons are over.
Yeah.
Just sitting there getting plans ready for next year.
Okay. Let's go back to mule deer hunting.
We shall.
Okay. So your strategy, you're trying to kill a mountain buck.
I'm trying to kill a mountain buck.
Okay. What kind of terrain are you looking for when you're trying to chase a mountain buck in that state? Because I know a lot of people like... they go to that open plains type hunting. They go to, break type stuff, coulee country, and the mountain hunting is just totally different. Mm-hmm. Is it like, do you see a lot of hunting pressure when you're hunting in the mountains?
Not as much like this time of year.
Yeah.
I feel like you see a bunch early. Mm-hmm. It's one of those, like, I think it's five weeks, six weekends. Mm-hmm. So people burn out.
Yeah.
My impression is people burn out sooner, and they also maybe convert over to either going to Eastern Montana or convert to road hunting. Mm-hmm. Which my favorite thing is, like, when it's cold and you can hike all day. You saw me last week, Brady. Like, when it's hot, I just shut down. So when it's cold and you can hike all day, get up high, do your thing up there.
You're like a golden retriever.
In many ways. So to answer your question, it's so thick around where I live, mm-hmm. used to live, I guess, that I'm looking for burns mainly. Like, that's just the... You can't hunt them in the thick stuff unless you're going to still hunt them all day. Mm-hmm. I just don't have the attention span for that.
Does anybody here have the attention span for still hunting? Maybe trail?
It's something trail. I've always wanted to do, but you need the snow though. And you have to be kind of solo, I think. It'd be so hard if you're like...
For sure. Also need the right kind of snow though too. You can't have the crusted over snow.
No. Yeah.
You got to have that real soft, sugary... Mm-hmm. Like, it's got to make for the right...
Fresh.
Yeah, super fresh, super sugary and cold. So it hasn't melted and iced over and crusted, and now it's loud. But I just, even if it was perfect conditions, I still don't know if I'm cut out for that. I'd rather sit in a tree stand, honestly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you have a gun, you're like, man, I'm looking at 30 yards ahead of me, but I could shoot hundreds of yards,
Yeah. Few times I've done it just because... Whatever, in the moment, it was just the thing I decided to do. It's like I'm constantly second guessing myself. Like, are they already busted? Am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Am I this? I'd rather just sit in a tree stand and like, okay, if they come, it happens. If they don't, they don't. Yeah. But when you're still hunting, it's like you're making it happen while also trying to let it happen at the same time. And it's like a constant battle in my head of like, okay, what do I do?
What I will say too... There's a hybrid version where when you're hiking and you cut the track, and I've never done this successfully, but I will brag for my brother for a second. He's done it with an elk and a moose where you're like just cooking, trying to get to a glassing spot or whatever. And there's a fresh track there and you convert from the hunting the open country,
to dogging the ground
to like, we're going to creep through here. We're going to go very slow. Follow these tracks, keep our eyes peeled. And that is a very like elevated experience too. Mm. Like when you're just like, they could be, they're in there somewhere. the tracks aren't lying. That is super fun.
Yeah.
That is super fun.
I've never successfully done that.
The only opposite side of that I've done before is glassing up tracks and then be like, okay, you know, you can see the tracks going through the snow and then all of a sudden they stop and they don't continue through the timber on the other side.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, like maybe they went up, maybe they went down, but they're somewhere in there and you just like really focus in and try to like glass them up if you have enough snow to
look
through the timber and try to pick them up that way.
Yep.
So what strategies are you going to try to employ in this? So like looking at burns, how do you figure out, this is always the hardest thing is like, okay, you're going to get to a spot in the morning, you're going to glass it. Maybe you see something, maybe you don't. Like when do you cross out that spot and continue to move on? Or you're like, cause it's a rut, maybe you'll sit there for a couple of days in the same area overlooking a big area you can glass, or you're just covering country that time of year.
Kind of depends. Like how much you can see is kind of important to me. And also what you would move on to next. Like, I think, you know, you probably do the same where you're working off your gut feel of like, where are the hot spots in this area? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider myself like the bona fide expert on this, but I like to cover country. I like to sit long enough to where if they're going to move, like you're going to see them. But I'm a little bit impatient. I like to get up and go. And if you get cold too, get up and go so you warm back up.
Yeah. It's like what would be a good day hunting the mountains, like deer number wise?
Okay. So I had a day a couple years ago where I think I saw like 40 deer and like 6 or 7 bucks. None of them were within range to shoot. They were kind of a ways off. But I've been goose egged so many times as well. And then the density is pretty low. We were looking at that chart a couple weeks ago in region 2, where it seems like the numbers may have bottomed out. And seem to be coming back up. So, I think like it's not uncommon to go and see zero, but we'll go and see 10 or 15. And if you can turn up a buck in there, this time of year, that's not out of the question. So, it's definitely not like the most game rich environment though.
Mm-hmm. And then like, so hunting the mountains, hunting that part of the state, is there ever concern though? Like, the country can be so big where like, yeah, you might be glassing a burn, but you can't get a shot off right there. So like, what's the thought process there? Like you see one on the other side and you try to get on that same face and hope there's enough topography then to maybe sneak through some timber to get a shot. Or is it just like.
Most of the areas I hunt are tight enough that it's not like, it's not big enough country to be like, okay, I'm going to have to like hurdle over these matchsticks for 800 yards before I can shoot it. Mm-hmm. There's some steep, tight kind of stuff that I like to hunt where you could reasonably shoot across it if you had to. And I've killed a handful of deer, doing it that way. So that's generally my approach. And the country doesn't really lend itself, at least where I'm at, to like seeing a lot of things that are miles away. That's kind of how it goes for me anyway. I'd pick spots too, based on like where you could shoot from. You know,
so that's the stuff you would look at if you're like e-scouting it. Let's say you've never been there before. How would someone would go about e-scouting a mountain hunt in that state? Just like tight canyons, a little bit of open stuff. You're looking for burns. You're looking just get up on ridge lines and look down. And
yeah. And I like not to get too technical on our product, but like, I like to, you know, I look for the areas where things round off on the topo line. So you think you can see you can see kind of a wide field of view, but I love that tool that we have where you're like, I forget what we call it, but it's the 3D measure one where you can see how far all the shots are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That one's super handy for like where you plan your sits and like where you, if you know you need to be here by this time, or if you think they're going to start moving and you may or may not have time to go after them. Like that's pretty handy for like planning where you want to be and when, and where you can shoot from. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's a matter of like knowing how far you're comfortable shooting.
Any other terrain features you kind of look for besides for burns? Like any, like what aspect you're looking at? Are you looking at north facing slopes, west, east type of thing? We're all about giving people info in this podcast. It's now I'm not the one giving my info.
You tell me. No, I don't know. You tell me, Brady. You're just digging into all my secrets.
I just want to dig into your secrets, man.
A big chest of secrets over there.
No, yeah. I don't have a big chest of secrets. Right? I'd have a much more impressive looking office actually.
I mean, that time of year, it can be anyone's guess, really. They can be on any face. It kind of depends on, obviously, the terrain, the steepness. But, like, yeah, I don't...
Pressure.
I don't, Yeah, you try to look at everything, I think, is the main thing. I mean, east facing, west facings are always pretty good, but definitely don't overlook north facing slopes too. Like some of that big, thick, nasty stuff. Like a lot of times you could have a bucks and some does slipping through that stuff. So I don't think there's probably one face that someone should just absolutely focus on, because you say that, and then like you could turn around and boom, there's some deer on the other side too. So you got to look at it all.
Yeah. Brady's saying this, but I know for a fact he has a spreadsheet
of what faces produce more.
Yes.
I mean, look.
I do.
any east facing, they're going to be feeding on that in the mornings, right? Like east or west facing.
And then what happens with the east facing slope in the afternoon? It gets the first shade.
Yeah, exactly.
So like that's always really good, because if you're glassing it, it's going to suck in the afternoon because you're glassing towards the setting sun. But it's going to have all the shadows already on it, and so deer are probably likely to slip out in the open.
It depends on where it's at. Elevation, snow cover, all that stuff. Obviously, a lot of variables. But like east west is going to hold the feed. East more so, right? Isn't that what you found?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. East more so, it's going to get more sunlight through the morning.
Yeah, because the west side sometimes, and depending on the mountains, it usually gets burnt off.
Yeah,
because you get a lot more of that hotter sun earlier in the year, because like it's just
up. So the better, wetter feed is going to be on the east facing.
Mm-hmm.
So like feed times, focus there.
So let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
So you were saying in the desert, just mornings are everything. You always say that.
Yep.
So if you're in the mountains and it's like, let's call it late October to November, when are you shooting most of these deer? Is morning still
middle of the day
when they're most? Oh, middle of the day.
Middle of the day.
I still think morning is beyond important.
It's very
more
important.
So than an evening still.
But I think usually like that rut time, you get deer that are kicking up, moving around, and it's whatever reason. Like your morning might not pan out, and maybe it's just because I didn't see anything in the morning. Then you're working around, and all of a sudden you see something like at 10 o'clock, and you end up killing it at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Thinking back of all the November mule deer I've killed. Like literally, I can't think of a single one that I killed before like 10 a.m., 9 a.m.
Are they like
10 a.m.?
Are they leaving a group? Are you killing them like when they're on the search for more does? Like are they on does in the morning and you're finding them like leaving that group to go elsewhere? Or why is it like, because they're not necessarily more active in the middle of the day, are they?
They're not densely more active, but I think it's just maybe it's just the terrain too. By the time you get over there into position, and then you're kicking up more deer as you're kind of moving through. Mm. And so like
thinking about like my three big deer that I've killed in the rut, all three of them, I did not find them in the morning. Did not find them in the gray light. They were not the first deer I glassed up. All three of them I killed because their does were bedded and they were up feeding.
Mm-hmm.
All three of them. Mm. My three biggest rut deer, that's how I killed them. And I don't know if that's because like, you know, they get the personal time finally, the does aren't up on their feet, so they're not rutting them and dogging them and doing this and doing that. Like all the does are bedded and then they were up feeding, and that's all three of those, that's how I killed. If I think back on some of the other ones, I don't know if that would still be the case, but the three biggest deer I've killed in the rut, that's how they got killed. It's like 10 to between 10 and noon, and they were up on their feet feeding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the two biggest rut bucks I have, since we're giving information, east facing slope, right at like an hour before shooting light ended. That's when I killed them.
Afternoon.
I glassed them. The one buck I did glass up in the morning, and obviously it took me a long time to get over there.
How'd you glass him up? What was he doing?
He was rutting does.
Yeah.
Moving through some open stuff in between. It was like aspen country, so in between aspens and dark timber. But kind of on an open face with some sage on it too, and then just like slipped over this little knob and went embedded, and then it took me so long to get over there, and then I didn't want to like push the situation because I figured they were gonna be bedded, so I waited till the evening to actually put a stock on it, and that was the one buck I shot. Like
of the three, the one I killed with my bow. Now that it just jogged my memory on it, I found him. Clay and I found him at like 9 a.m. and he was rutting does. That's how we found him. Then they all bedded. But how I killed him was he got up to feed, and the does were bedded.
Doesn't it make you panic a little bit when knowing they could move like miles and miles and miles during one day during the rut?
Oh, yeah.
But you guys have killed all these when they've stayed there.
Yeah. It's stressful.
Like they could be on the other next mountain over by the time you're like ready to try and shoot them.
Yeah. I don't know. If I think back on like all the rut deer, because it's more than three. But like those three just stand out in my mind because they're the big ones that I've killed. I mean, I don't, like I said, I don't know if it would be true for all of them, but I'm pretty sure none of them were like a transition, like a buck by himself going to look for does on the move. I don't think I've killed one like that. I'm pretty sure. I think they've all been tucked with does.
Yeah. And I was telling you on the elk hunt the other week, that one buck we tried to chase, you know, it was a surprising, like, saw this buck from a long distance away in the morning, and he was going to check out this doe group, and instantly none of the does were probably hot enough, and he starts leaving. We're like, we're just going to fucking run after him. And we just literally start chasing him. And every time we get over a ridge and look over and find him again, he's just walking off to another doe group. And then we drop down, keep creeping on closer. Yeah. And then he's going to another doe group again. He's like, he has a mission in mind, check out as much does as he can. And just keeps walking and walking and walking and putting miles on and miles on.
We I got a story for you that'll make you more stressed. And it's very recent. Okay. So there is a big deer. Like, I mean, big deer in one of the units here in Nevada. Okay. And I know the team that was like on him trying to find him. I'm friends with him, staying close with him, whatever. So I have like fresh intel on this deer all the time because it's a big deer and all of us are like excited to get on the hoof footage or, you know, a hunter kills him, whatever. And he was taking some hunters into where this deer lived. Never saw this deer on the hoof. Not one time, not a single time did they ever see this deer on the hoof. He was on a spring, had him on camera. Then cameras go away. They're out there glassing all through velvet, all through September, all through October. Never see this deer on the hoof. Okay. He's got a late season hunter in a completely different unit. And on October, shit, when that would have been, it was before Halloween, which makes the story crazier. It's before Halloween. Okay. He's 22 miles away from where he had this buck on camera, 22 miles away. It's a giant ass deer. It's like, not mistaking it. 22 miles away. Never seen this deer on the hoof. He's had his whole team in there looking. He's looked himself, nothing. And we're all like so excited to see video of him on the hoof to see if he really is what they had on camera or like how he finished, because you got to pull him July 31st or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever the date is. Very first day of the hunt with his rifle hunter in a completely different unit, 22 miles away. Very first deer they glass up is him. He's with 12 does rutting his absolute face off. 400 yards away, they kill him. 22 miles away in a completely different unit.
Just by accident?
I mean, he obviously wasn't going in for that. It was a different unit. Yeah. Like, he never in his mind did he think, like, oh, we're looking for a buck. He went to a good spot. I mean, he
knows
outfits and guides and been doing it for a long time in all these different areas. So he knew he was going into, like, a good spot. There was going to be deer, you know. But the very first deer they glass up is one that they've been trying to get video of since July 15th. Like, they knew he was a big deer July 15th in a completely different unit in the desert. And he was not in the desert, 22 miles away. And very first year they glass up is him. 22 miles. Think about that.
The other crazy part is probably nobody saw him go 22 there. Miles.
No.
So he snuck 22 miles away.
Correct. Probably all just in one night. And he just showed up and he said he was rutting his absolute face off. Fought a 3-point, got his ass kicked by a 3-point. That's on video. It's pretty cool. Like, you would never, he postures up on this 3-point because he's got the 12 does. 3-point spins him downhill, tips him over, beats the shit out of him, breaks off one of his points, stands back up, and then they kill him. But he got beat by a small 3-point.
Gosh, well, if he went 22 miles the night before, that's explainable.
Yeah,
but think of the hunter having no idea, being like, wow, I have the greatest guide of all time. Like, he just walked out here.
Very first year they saw.
Monster deer.
Well, think about his mindset. They've tried so hard to, like, figure this deer out. And then never in a million years would he expect that was the deer that they were going to see there.
That is amazing.
And then to make it even crazier, he has video of that buck, which he didn't notice until he killed it. He has video of that buck in the exact same spot the year before in the rut.
So,
but he just didn't realize it was the same deer until he put his hands on it and started looking at pictures. It's like, holy shit, that's the deer from last year that we didn't kill.
Huh.
Crazy.
That's pretty wild.
22 miles away. Like, that stresses me out about rut hunts.
They cover country.
You don't hear a lot of stories of people being on the good end of that. They're like, oh, yeah, this buck, he just disappeared.
Yeah.
But when you're like, this buck just appeared,
Yeah, like, just randomly appear.
That's the good luck.
But it just stresses me out, man, because it's like you could see a buck in the distance and get so excited this time of year.
Yeah.
And then wake up the next morning and it's like it never existed in the first place. And he gets killed in a completely different unit.
Yeah, you know, like that when we were with my brother, he showed you that cactus buck we killed.
Yeah.
And like we literally glassed it up one day. We couldn't kill it. It was in the evening. Tried hunting that buck for multiple days. We ended up killing it 4.5 miles away.
Yeah.
And it was a cactus buck. So like it's probably not really rutting, but it's still hanging out with other deer, but it was traveled 4.5 miles.
So stressful, man.
During Thanksgiving.
That's why I like the velvet. If you find them once, they'll be there.
Yeah.
If you lay eyes on them once, that you just keep doing it and they'll be back there.
Yeah. I think another thing too, like why maybe like middle of the day and afternoon is pretty good during the rut is because like you can always glass up does that time of year, especially if you have snow. And you're just covering all the country around, like a little bit above, a little bit below, left, right, like in the thicker stuff.
Yeah.
And normally if you can see the does and are up on their feet, that's like a good sign. Like there's probably a buck somewhere in the vicinity. And then you're just really picking up the big eyes and trying to like dig them up somewhere around there. And then you glass them up like, oh, now we have the does. We know exactly where we have to get to. Hike all the way over there. The does are still there in that vicinity. Wait till the buck stands, kill the buck. I mean, that's ideally how it would
be. I'll be honest with you. I haven't had a rut tag in a while and I'm like... In this conversation right now, I'm like, man.
You went the full opposite direction. Kind of wish. Duck hunting.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What do you think?
I do miss it.
Snow versus no snow. How many points of good luck do you think snow adds on any given day?
Oh.
In November.
You had snow. It's game on. Like it adds so much excitement because you got the cold weather. Keep them on their feet. They got to dig around more to feed. You can glass them up. Yeah, it just makes things... a lot more fun.
I would normally say that it makes them easier to see, which is true. But after last week, just keeping them on their feet seems like we are the least successful elk hunters on the planet right now, Brady.
Yeah we are.
But if they were there,
Brady's not an elk hunter.
He was trying. We were both trying. Yeah. But if they were there, that we would have seen them.
Yeah, we couldn't glass into the thick stuff. We were glassing those aspens. You could see how like thick they were. But if you had snow, we could have picked them up. Like that little buck that we ended up seeing from that one glassing down. We were trying to wait in those three bulls.
Yeah.
Like he was there, but like we only saw him because he went in the really open. But we probably could have seen him earlier if we had snow cover. And how many other deer were probably in there that we had no clue about?
I got a deep answer into this. I think there's way more variable than just snow. And this is big game and waterfowl too. Mm-hmm. Like this is something that I've truly seen. Believe in, like, absolutely. So big game and waterfowl both. The snow itself is good. It is good, right? It's better than not because of glassing opportunity. Easier to see them. Mm-hmm. Tracks in the snow. You can tell how fresh they are so easy. But if they're frozen and crystallized, if they're fresh and powdery and still got that little drift on the front of the hoof, like, you can tell how fresh they are really easy. But if you get a snowstorm and it's one of those snowstorms that it's just kind of that wet, heavy snow. And then the next day is still low pressure, cloudy, overcast, kind of like not, it's cold, but not like that fresh feeling cold. Deer, elk, waterfowl, they still stay locked up in my opinion. Like that's what I've seen time and time and time again. Now, if you get a snowstorm that comes in, dumps some snow, and then breaks into high pressure for the next morning, like bluebird, 15 mile an hour wind, 10 mile an hour wind, have that like bitter feel to the air. Waterfowl, big game both. Holy shit, is it on that next day. Like, so I don't think it's as simple as just snow. I think it's the type of snow and then what's coming the next day or two, right? Like if that snowstorm breaks into high pressure and now you get that insulation cloud burn off because the clouds stay in and it's not snowing anymore. You get that insulation under there where it's going to stay warmer, right?
Yep.
Did you get that to break off the 10, 15 mile an hour wind, bluebird sky, high pressure? Oh,
vibes are good. Oh,
buddy. Like, I mean, just so good.
And then the visual of that buck moving around when he's breathing and you see all that breath going on in the air, that's like way cooler. That's way cooler than any elk bugle ever.
I
would agree with you.
I'm not kidding. I've like chills, goosebumps right now thinking about that. Yeah. Thinking about a day like that.
Yeah. They're.
It's that the high pressure, a high pressure, bitter cold, 10, 15 mile an hour wind day after a fresh snow. There's literally nothing better in November.
Mm. Some lucky person in fourth season Colorado right now is having that moment.
Is it broke today? Is it still? I think it's still snowing today, right?
Okay, so maybe tomorrow.
Tomorrow, I think it's tomorrow.
We had August weather, and somewhat. I think it's all just piling up, and fourth season's going to be bonkers this year. Well, it's probably already bonkers because it's going on right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm excited for waterfowl on those days. Like that, I'm waiting for one of those days.
Yeah.
That's just the mallard day.
Here's another thing. This is not animal related, but it's human related. About this time of year, hunting this time of year, that needs to be talked about more. Okay, so when you can contrast like late season rifle hunting, like we're kind of in the season four right now, versus, we were talking about this last week, Brady and I, versus elk hunting. You wake up so early, and I love archery elk hunting, so this isn't a dig on archery elk hunting, but you wake up so early, you're hiking into these areas.
Stay up so late.
It's hotter than hell. You're hunting the morning, and then you kill like a full work day in between the morning and the evening. It's 9 hours before it gets good again. Mm-hmm. So you're staying out there. It's hot. You're hunting the evening, hiking out, getting like 5 hours of sleep. And I feel like that wears on you so fast. But
are you talking about my elk hunt that I had in Wyoming?
Yes.
Because Omar, I talked to Omar about this. We would hunt in the morning. It was hot, did not good weather, not good rut activity. It was just ended up, it was very similar to your guys' elk hunt just during the rut.
Yeah.
I told Omar we were sitting on a bull that we were on in the morning. We'd got close to, we got within probably 150 yards, but he peeled off into the trees 30 minutes after sunrise. And I was talking to Omar. I said, it's like the second to last day of the hunt. And I've looked at Omar. I said, you know what's really crazy? He's like, what? If I got my truck right now, I would be home to my family before this bull's going to get back on his feet yes. and start running again. Like if I got my truck right now and we're just sitting there eating breakfast, like the morning hunt's over, and we obviously don't want to blow him out of the timber. We have a day and a half left. So it's like, mm-hmm. you don't want to get ultra aggressive.
Yes.
And I looked at him, I said, if I got my truck right now, I would be home hugging my kids and wife before this bull got up. And I'm in Wyoming right now.
Yeah,
like just think about that.
That stretch of the day
is horrible.
It's so long.
Horrible. Yeah.
And it's hot. So you contrast that with like you're kind of hunting all day this time of year.
You hunt all day.
Which I
all
love.
Day.
It's like you get done with the morning, you eat a little food, take a quick nap, and you're waking up and you're like things could reasonably be happening soon.
Yeah.
Then my favorite part is you get back to your camp, you eat dinner. Like I would get in my sleeping bag and fall asleep. And then wake up and check my phone being like, oh, maybe it's time, you know, get up pretty soon. It's like 9:15 p.m.
Yeah.
You're like, I have a very long night of sleeping ahead of me, which I need.
Brady appreciates that too.
Yeah, I do.
Brady
like is a sleeper.
Are you a sleeper?
I'm a sleeper.
Did he keep up with your sleeping regimen? Did Lane keep up with your sleeping?
I mean, he had some issues sleeping. Let's just talk about that for a quick second. Well, he was making these like dog
I was sick.
Moaning noises when he was sleeping.
I was sick. And so we're in a teepee, Dyneema teepee. So there's not much ventilation.
Yeah.
I think subconsciously I was trying to not cough on Brady.
Yeah.
You might have to do an impression. I was kind of waking myself up like as I was dozing off, but we might have to have Brady do an impression of.
It's literally like a dog whimpering.
Some of the noises I was making.
Like no joke, like constantly. And then he like wakes himself up a little bit and then he turns over and then he starts like moaning again.
That's pretty funny.
I'm like, did you do this at home? Your wife could not be happy with you. Like, do you sleep in another room? Like I was like all these thoughts. And he's like, just because I'm sick right now.
It was because I was sick.
Do you know that? Is that like a normal sickness noise you make?
No.
Does your wife tell you that?
No, never done it before.
You were just conscious of Brady being in the tent.
I don't know. I've never done it before, but I would wake myself up doing it. So like every morning I'd have a little status check in with Brady and that was my, like my barometer of how sick I was. He's like, oh, he is still pretty bad last night. But,
Brady's a Navy SEAL in the backcountry.
What do you mean?
Like when he tells his body like, hey, we need to sleep and we need to sleep good right now so we can crush tomorrow. I've never seen anything like it.
I was going to say.
Dude lays down, sleeps, wakes up, like, I mean, fully sleeps through the night.
I was going to say that like you think of Brady, you watch these films of Brady and you're like, dude, that guy is so hardcore, which he is. Don't get me wrong. But when it comes to sleep, like that's a very serious matter for Brady.
Yeah, he's a Navy SEAL. I can sleep through everything. Remember Bigfoot walking through camp?
We did.
Supposedly, I didn't hear anything.
They
woke up in the morning and they both were like, hey, did you hear that walking around camp last night? And Luke's like, yeah, I thought it was you guys like walking around taking a pee. And they're like, no, something was walking close to our camp. I'm like,
not a four-legged animal?
Luke and I, no.
Totally not.
I was kind of right in and out of sleep. I think Luke was the same, but we heard the footsteps and they were not that far away. But what we can say is there probably weren't any bears out there that time of year.
Yeah, probably not.
It was not a hoofed animal. Like you could hear, you know how you can hear like
heel toe.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So it wasn't like stomping. It was like a foot.
It is
some
a different
sort.
Cadence. A four-legged hoofed animal is a stomp.
Yes.
A foot is a heel toe cadence. Like it's a.
Yes. Yeah. So two of the three of us confirmed that the actual noise. Brady wasn't awake, but I'm not saying it was Bigfoot. I'm just not saying that it wasn't. I know what it wasn't. It wasn't a bear, a moose, an elk, or a deer. So.
We need you guys on the Halloween podcast now.
Yeah. Well, then we talked to, one would say his name, but we talked to Luke's friend, mm-hmm. and he had a Bigfoot story he was telling about. I can't remember what, that was like back east somewhere.
I think he said it was in Tennessee.
Yeah, of like, he was like hiking around, was he turkey hunting or something? Or
yeah.
Something like that, where all of a sudden this like, he's like, it's a 5-gallon bucket sized boulder was launched into the air towards him and like landed near him. And he's like, he started running towards the direction. He's like, I gotta figure out what this was. It's like a boulder, like a human couldn't throw a boulder. Like he said, it was like sky high, like tree level coming down and like hit right next to him. And he ran over there and it was just gone. There was no noise in anything. He's like, where did this boulder get tossed? Like something
he
tossed
saw
a boulder.
It fly through the air.
He like saw the boulder come up out of the trees is what he said.
Yeah. And this boulder's coming towards him.
He also.
Did he inspect the boulder?
No, I don't think so.
He didn't say. Here's what he also said.
That's pretty wild.
We won't say his name, but he's like a mountain man. Dude, like
the definition of a mountain man, this is him. Like he could probably kick my ass in the mountains, no joke. Like he's a savage.
He's one of those like truly.
Yes.
Looks like a mountain
man. So here's what he said. Guy loves the mountains, spends all of his time in the mountains. What he said that he was so scared that for the next year and a half, he was not. Did he say he wasn't in the mountains when it was dark or wasn't in the mountains by himself?
By himself, I think, yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't in the mountains by himself for the next year and a half because he was so scared.
Damn. We need him on the Halloween podcast.
Yeah. And, like he started packing now because of that. He's like, I don't pack for like bears or whatever, but like obviously a little bit for bears, but like I pack all the time because of the unknown, because of that shit that's out there.
Scary when you say it that way. Yeah. That is pretty wild, actually.
Yep.
Yeah.
That would rattle you. For sure that rattle you. I mean,
so that could have been, you know, Bigfoot out there.
Could have been.
Probably was.
He was nice to us, but
yeah.
There we go.
Or didn't I scared him food. Off with my sleeping noises.
Yeah, that's probably true. He disturbed my Lord of the Rings book.
I'm telling
you
though, Brady is the Navy SEAL of the backcountry.
Yeah.
Like when it's rest time, he tells his body and his body rests.
It is funny because he gets in and he puts down 10 pages of The Hobbit. And then like instantly just gone. Light switch goes off and he's done.
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive, dude. It really is.
Yeah.
I can sleep anywhere, anytime. It's great, great shit. Quality. It People is. Can be noisy, loud.
I can't do that. I always like, that's one of the things I struggle with in the backcountry is just that whole sleep and rest side of it. Like I know I'm not going to sleep real good. So my body's going to break down more and more and more by the days.
Mm-hmm. Is it just like restfulness or do you get cold or what?
No, it's more like restfulness. I'm excited for the next day. I'm hunting, you know, I'm a side sleeper and that doesn't do real well on sleeping pads. I'm also like a heavier guy.
What about grizzlies? Do they bother you?
No, that stuff doesn't really bother me. It's more so just not being, I'm a really light sleeper, very light. I sleep with earplugs. Even at home, any night doesn't matter. Even at home, I'm sleeping with earplugs.
I noticed that because when I watch Camo, I find him in my yard.
Yeah. Yeah. He'll eat them. Yeah. He's been known to eat my earplugs. But yeah, I'm just a really light sleeper. So you just, you know, not being in a bed and in the comfort of my own home, which I'm still not sleeping all the way through the night, even on those. And then you take me into the backcountry, and it's like the excitement of the hunt, everything that happened before. I'm thinking about what I want to do the next day from what I just learned the day previous, what we have going forward. Is tomorrow the day? You know, all those thoughts. And then I'm on a sleeping pad being a side sleeper. It's just, I've never been good at that. Or like taking naps. I'm so jealous of Omar. He's not a Navy SEAL by like the Brady Miller style, but man, that guy can take some naps.
He can take some, especially in a vehicle. I'm like,
I would love to sleep right now for the, we got an 8-hour shift before these elk stand up. I would love to take a nap.
Yeah.
And I got no shot of taking a nap right
Nothing.
Now.
Mm-hmm. That'll wear you out quick.
Yeah.
Oh, let's talk mule deer rut dates. When did you think the mule deer rutting in mountains of Montana?
Pick here. We, so Brady and I talked about this on the previous podcast. Pick one day, the one day in your mind that stands out as like things are different. From I noticed this day, things are now different.
Like the best day or the like the we've turned the corner.
Yeah, like you notice like things are different.
I would say any of those first few days of November.
First few?
Yeah.
Pick a day.
Then November 3rd.
Ooh, Romeo's birthday.
That's that deer I have on the wall. That's when I shot that deer.
Okay. And he was starting to sniff a little bit?
He was lonesome, and I think that was making him rut pretty hard. It was cold. There was no does in the area, and this thing was just cooking.
Hmm.
So we saw him at the top. Then we see him at the bottom. Then we see him back up at the top. I think he was very...
looking for love.
Confused at the time. But I think you get, like, first few weeks of the season... late October, it's just, it doesn't feel like it's not bitter cold. Like the mornings don't feel as crisp, but those early November days, I feel like you just turn the corner and you're also more like hopeful and optimistic during those days.
Yeah. You think that's a product of being more north, Brady, like those Montana bucks, that it's a slight bit earlier?
Slight bit earlier. Yeah, probably.
Because Brady's pick was November 9th.
November 9th.
That's like his day he's noticed. And all the hunting he's done, that things are different.
That's a good switch point. And that's also when I've killed both my two orange deers, exactly November 9th.
November 9th.
November 11th was my day.
Don't you think when you, by November 9th, though, here's a theory for you. I don't have much to substantiate this, but it is a theory. That early rut, but like November 9th, they're with a half dozen does, right?
Mm-hmm.
If not more. They have to cover country to find those. So I feel the same way about elk, not that I'm an expert elk hunter, but those days on the front end of it, when they actually have to go from like, I'm going to sleep in the trees all day to I'm going to come out and try and find these does. Those can be some of the most productive days because they're just out looking.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, things are different than two. I'm talking about like the light switch of like, oh, this shit is on.
I would say if the question is, when is the rut really cooking? I would agree with like that second weekend of November.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when, in terms of like not even wasting your time, hardly late October to November, early November, I feel like is when in the mountains, you're like, I have a pretty good shot of seeing one.
Yeah. Things are crawling.
Last couple weekends of October, I'm kind of like, I feel like I'm going out cause I kind of have to.
Yeah, I would agree.
When's the earliest you've ever seen some rut activity? Let's take out like Fork and Horns out of the question because they're always kind of just
mature activity. Yeah.
That buck I have in the wall is the earliest, probably like rutting, good rutting deer I've ever seen, which was like
first couple days. Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't say I've ever really, I think I've shot one deer in October in there and he wasn't even rutting. So I don't know. I know you've seen him way sooner, like when you were doing one more ridge and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually around like that. If it's past like October 20th in some states, you can kind of get a little hint of some pre-rut activity moving around. It seems like, especially if you have some snow and cold weather.
Yeah, I was going to say when it's hot, it wouldn't even bother.
Yeah, it wouldn't even bother. Do you know how to exactly calculate peak rut dates for mule deer?
No.
Okay, so.
I don't either. Please tell us.
Yeah, so I have an article I have pulled up on my computer right now. It's called The Mule Deer Rut and the Science Behind What Triggers Optimum Rut Dates. This is an article I wrote in conjunction with Dave Lozier way back in the day. We've refreshed it over the years, updated more data, and I've added more context to it. Usually I republish it quite a bit. So if you want to determine when the peak mule deer rut will be in your area, you can take the peak/average birthing date for mule deer in the state you're considering hunting and then subtract roughly 202 to 210 days for gestation. So peak rut date, average fawn drop period, basically minus like 205 days. So if you know your fawns are dropping the first week of June,
how do you know that?
That's what my question was.
How do you get that data? How do you know that?
Biology, baby.
They have like the biologists produce that.
Yeah, that's why I'm always a big promoter of reading actually like biology reports, peer reviewed journals, all these different studies they do, GPS collar data, when they actually determine okay when the fawn's dropping in your area, or if you're just a local and you're driving around in the summer, you're like,
notice.
Hey, yeah, we're noticing a bunch of fawns right now, and like wherever that peak day is, usually it's at like first couple weeks of June for a lot of the western states. Depends on obviously how north you are and how south you are in all these states, but you can take that rough day, like, you know, let's call it June 9th, subtract 205 days from there, depending on obviously what it is. And that's probably what you could consider start of your like peak rut per se.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know what Brady's doing? He's acting like this is this big theory that he came up with and did all this science, but it's just the Super Bowl babies thing applied to deer, right?
Yeah. Like how all it is.
All these babies get born 9 months after the Super Bowl in the town that, in the city that wins it.
That won it. Yeah.
This is just the Super Bowl baby theory applied to mule deer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't exactly. It? Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
Nice work.
But they average 202 to 210 days for gestation. So like you can in humans, you can just backdate all this stuff.
Yeah.
Huh. So the states produce like fawn drop data?
A lot of them do. Like a lot of them might not be totally exact. It could be like a certain area of, let's say, Montana. And it might vary if you're going from western Montana to eastern Montana. But on average, just figure out when they're dropping their fawns. Again, some could do early, some could do late, because it could be depending on the fawn or the doe, you know, when she actually got bred, or, you know, the age of her. But like pretty typical 202 to 210 days of gestation for a mule deer.
So if you have the option between, you know, the exact peak rut date on paper, or, you know, the coldest day within 6 days on either side of that,
which one pressure,
which one are you, which one are you choosing?
I mean, a state like that, you know, I'm usually hunting later because I'm hoping there's less people in the field, and then I get a lot more colder temperatures. Snow is going to keep people back at their hotel or whatever. So like I'm kind of a little opposite sometimes, and hoping there's still a little bit of rut activity going on, but I know that cold weather is going to keep bucks on their feet. Mm-hmm. But like usually that middle of November in a lot of areas, that's like, gosh, that'd be a prime time.
I would choose the coldest high pressure day for sure. Like I would rather choose that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to, somewhere in that window, you're going to probably find them. So like the elk rut, you know, it's like this year Trail was saying what he saw a ton of bulls when he was hunting his spike. They're already ripping, and that was end of August.
Yeah.
He's like, gosh, it seemed like it might be an early rut this year. And then you guys go to whatever state you hunted, and it seemed like you might've missed it. And it might've been what, a week earlier.
Yeah. We missed it by, I think the locals we talked to and people that were super cool. It was honestly really cool. We ran into a lot of people that were fans of the brand and validated everything we're doing. It was awesome. So, and they shared some information with us. It sounds like we missed it by about 9 days. Mm-hmm. We were about 9 days too late. Our first day of the hunt was nine days too late. It was a little earlier.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then what also really drives a rut too is photo period. As most people know, like the amount of, basically amount of daylight you have in a 24-hour period. So it starts to drop down. Like I have a chart too pulled up here for Montana. We're looking at the amount of hours of daylight in a 24-hour period during the rut month. So October 15th, this is just an average area pulled in Montana. So you get 10.7 hours of daylight. October 15th, October 31st, it drops down to 9.8. November 15th, 9.1. November 30th, 8.5. And then obviously December is a little bit too later for all these seasons, but it drops down December 15th, 8.2. So it's like when it goes from like 10.7, starts dropping down a little bit into that like low 9 amount of hours of daylight. Seems like that's like, you know, you're probably gonna see some rut activity around that time.
Yeah, for sure. I was told you lose 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes at night every day from, I think, the equinox is when that starts. Is that true? That's just something I was told a long time ago, and I've always kind of held that.
Roughly true.
2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes at night is what I've always gone off of.
Are those the same day, the same photo periods? Are they on the same, or is the amount of sunlight the same on the same day every year? Like is November 15th the same amount of
I bet it varies a little bit. Leap probably year. Because our calendar is slightly messed up, isn't it?
That's why we have to add leap year, right?
Imprecise,
yeah.
So it can vary a little bit, but obviously you're starting to lose daylight and that's what's kind of really kicking it off. So it's like, obviously photo period, it's cold weather because it's going to keep them on their feet. And, you know, hopefully you're going to have a combination of all that stuff happening that's going to make a true rut. Like,
yeah.
And you're going to see more deer.
It does feel like some years it's just got a little bit of extra magic than versus others.
Yeah.
I think those, like, when you get the really long cold snaps is when you're like, dang, yeah, that was a solid rut this year.
Well, and what's the guy's name from Utah we had on the podcast? So knowledgeable.
Brock McMillan.
Is that who it was?
Yeah.
I don't know if it was that name. We did a couple podcasts with him. We did one at the Western Hunt Expo.
Yeah.
Brock. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Okay. Dude, he's so knowledgeable on this. And I mean, it makes total sense, and I guess I roughly paid attention to this, but didn't take it as serious as what he's saying. The aggression of the rut, or like the activity of the rut, is dependent on the body health of the does.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. So like it's hugely important how good the rut's going to be, more so than the weather, is what he's saying. Mm-hmm. So if the does are coming off good feed and got good body fat percentage and healthy, you know, eating good food all through the fawning and summer range and all that stuff, like that's what leads to really good rut.
Didn't he also say that is one of the biggest determining factors of the eventual, like, highest potential of a buck?
Yeah.
Is the health of the mother.
The body fat of the
doe.
Everything boils down to the body fat level of the doe.
That is so crazy.
It's crazy.
It's like the very headwaters of all this other things that have to happen correctly.
And it's something it's overlooked, right? Because all of us pay attention to weather and this and high pressure, low pressure, all this stuff. And it's like, we really should be paying attention to, like, June body fat levels of does.
Yeah.
That's the lead metric.
That's boring, but it's probably way more accurate.
So here's another cool thing too, in the same article that we published on Go Hunt. So I have a chart. I haven't updated this chart since 2019. So obviously some of this data could be a little bit differently, but basically I broke down the top 200 Boone and Crockett typical and non-typical mule deer killed since 1990 by month. All right, I'll just group typical, non-typical together. So we'll just start at like August. So August, 5 total. This is the top 200 deer. So it could change, obviously, since 2019. But 5 total, Boone and Crockett, typical, non-typical. September, you have 40. October, you have 127. And typically, a lot of times, October is a little peak because that's when you kind of have more tags in the field. So like, it's kind of skewed
a little bit.
November, 132. December 29, January 14, and obviously a lot of states are closed by then. But in terms of like typical, non-typical, like October for typical, you have 69 typical Boone and Crockett bucks. November, you have 56, and then non-typical in October is 58, and November it was 76. So you can see that little peak. And obviously October and November are very close together, so a lot of those could have been killed like end of October.
But if you think about it though, you take the variable in that we know, which is way more tags in October than November. But November is keeping up with October. So if you look at it from a percentage standpoint, the percentage of tags killing big deer in November is way heavier than October.
Yep. So yeah, November's king for taking big bucks.
I need a tag again.
I know.
Yeah.
I need a November tag.
You need a November tag.
Mm-hmm. What are you looking for in optic setups when you're hunting a mountain hunt for mule deer?
Sig stabilized. That's it.
Shout out to Sig, sponsor of the podcast.
In all seriousness, those have replaced a spotting scope in so much mountain hunting for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, a spotting scope would be great, but to carry that and a gun, dude, those things are unbelievable. I know you guys have talked about them ad nauseum on the podcast, but I would say more often than not this time of year, I'm going to go out with just 16s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
16s are such a good, like, in between. They're a little tight. If you're like just trying to scan and glass things up, but dude, that's it.
It is. The other thing too about late season is all the gear you're carrying in your backpack, all that late season gear that you're constantly peeling off to hike and then put back on when you sit to glass. It's like, there's not a lot of room left in your pack on a late season hunt.
Yeah. And like, if you're taking food for all day and like, selfishly, I generally, we'll bring a camera, which doesn't, you know, which full of glass weighs a little bit.
But you want to bring it. I mean,
yeah, I want to. Dude, those are such a good.
So to drop a tripod and a spotting scope, open up some room because of those, big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Especially if you're going to, I mean, if the name of the game is going to be to hike and to, yeah, like if moving, if you're just going up to a glassing spot, yeah, throw a tripod in or a spotting scope in. But if you're going to move, you know, that's a consideration now where it's like either take one of those little Vortex, you know, 33s or whatever they are and a tripod or just leave it.
Mm-hmm. No. You really don't need a spotting scope a lot of times unless you're like really, really looking for big deer. Like you could probably get by with a pair of 16s and then just like really grill up the terrain. If you can see a big frame, go after it if you're happy with that. But
yeah,
ditch a lot of weight. Yeah. Is there any other essential pieces of gear you take on a late season hunt?
I try to take some comfort food. You saw me with, what did I bring? Hot chocolate.
Hot chocolate. You had a giant bag of nuts, like weighed a pound, it felt like.
I brought honey roasted peanuts.
What is that? Why?
It's what's just that peanuts that I'm pretty sure they just roll it in sugar and call it honey roasted.
Okay.
So food, like I think comfort food's kind of important up there if you're going to be out there all day in the wind, like getting whipped in the wind and everything.
There
like,
is something about comfort food in the cold.
Yeah.
There's something about it.
So a jet boil.
Or yeah. Something. I was going to say you do bring a stove every single day.
I brought a stove every day, a couple coffees, hot chocolate. Cook up some ramen. Yeah. Cook up some ramen, cook up some food, glassing pad. We had the prototype booties out there for a while.
So nice.
Those things are pretty sweet. They're not like wait out the bitter cold type of equipment, but if you want to slip your feet in there and get cozy and like you can walk around, mm-hmm. those it's are pretty best. Awesome and yeah. they weigh absolutely nothing.
I've had them on all my hunts.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
And then like big gloves too, down gloves. I actually didn't bring those on our hunt. I wish I would have, but you know, a glassing mitt. You had those, I forget which ones they were, but those waterproof.
Oh yeah, Stone Glacier
ones that like, those are kind of important too, just to keep your hands. So mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, it's cool to go ultra light and it's cool to be fast and all that. But you got to take a few things that might keep you out there longer or make you, you know, not want to go home as bad.
Yeah, more comfortable in the moment too. So you're not trying to shiver and stay warm and do this when you should be in the glass. Like keep yourself comfortable.
Yeah.
Make sure your eyes are in the glass.
Yeah, make sure your jet boil canister's full because a couple years ago, I melted one because I got up there and it was empty.
Really?
So I had all this food and all this hot chocolate and everything. Couldn't use any of it because I melted my jet boil. That so make sucks. Sure, for a little pro tip, make sure you actually have fuel for your jet boil.
What about survival stuff, fire start? Are you a type of person late season you're going to start a fire in the middle of the day or get warm, like that sort of stuff? What are you taking for fire?
Yeah, I have a windproof lighter, take some of that pyro putty stuff. And then I think a long time ago, I heard, I think it was Aaron Snyder talk about this stuff called, I think it's trioxane. It's like a military thing. And there's these little tabs. You start one of those on fire, dude, and you're like burn the forest down.
Yeah.
So I keep a couple of those little tablets in my, pack because if you can just get a spark on those, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely keep some stuff to make a fire and that'll keep you out there.
Yeah. I'm trying to pull up what's the ones I use, little fire tablets. You search fire tablets in Google and you get a bunch of this like Amazon fire tablet. Like,
dude, Amazon comes one of those up too. With everything now. It's pretty wild. Like everything I search now, Amazon pulls up number one.
Yeah. I always carry those S-Bit. That's what it is. S-Bit solid fuel tablets. Those are what I use a lot for like helping me start a fire in like a Argo Hunt titanium stove, but Pyro Putty King.
Pyro Putty. Yep. Joking aside, taking a Kindle, like an Amazon Kindle reader, you can kill some serious time occupying your mind with a book that weighs nothing.
Yeah.
I'm not a reader though.
I'm not like a huge reader, but when you're out there just like looking at a tree the whole time.
True.
Brady had the Kindle app. And honestly, like I think keeping your mind occupied on some of those days is actually can go a long ways.
I can just forego the Kindle and just like read on my phone and it's like really, really good. And then it syncs up with my Kindle when I get back home, all the pages I read. So like, you know, to read a little bit. I think it's key.
Yep.
Switch your mind over a little bit. You don't need to watch rot on Netflix that you have downloaded in the backcountry. You
can like Omar?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. He cannot sit in silence or like with nothing going on. He has to watch something. Every day I'm not kidding. Anytime there's downtime, he's watching something on his phone if he's not sleeping.
That's not me, but
not me
that's
either.
Okay. That's all right if it's Omar.
You said you had some questions for us.
Yeah. We just got done with a full season. So I just wanted to ask you guys, this is out of left field, but I was thinking about this on the way in today. What is a hunting regulation that you would like to see either added or removed? After you just got out there, you just spent a ton of days out in the field. What is something that you would like to see either added or removed?
Do you got something right now? Or do you want me to go? What do you think?
I mean, I have one that's top of mind, but it's not in the big game world.
Is it waterfall based? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we'll skip you. I'll go with mine.
Okay.
And Lorenzo can talk about his waterfall stuff.
I'll think of a big game one. That's just one just top of mind. Super.
I was just joking about the waterfall thing, by the way. It doesn't have anything to do with my season right now. But if I could change right now one regulation, it would be Wyoming wilderness law that a non-resident can't hunt the wilderness. Stop with the outfitter handouts. If the outfitters can't get clients in the area and have to try to control everything, they're just really bad at marketing. It's safe for me to go into the wilderness area and fly fish. I can hike. I can take photos. But the second I have a big game tag in my hand, I can't hunt there. Really? Like, come on.
I agree. That on 100%, I agree, because I dealt with it this year.
I know a lot of outfitters. They're great people.
Yeah.
Like, they're great people.
Great people. Here's the thing, though. Like, I was very open with this in Wyoming when I was meeting with the fish and game guy. So anyways, so I dealt with this in Wyoming, right? We're out there. It's not the best hunting. A lot of people side by sides, trucks, trailers, this, that, everything, and roads everywhere. Omar and I, we call what's his name? Kenneth. From Kifaru. Stud of a guy. Got to spend time with him, which that is the cool part is I knew him. I knew he was a nice guy, but I spent 3 days with him in the wilderness. Awesome guy.
He's a beast. Like,
total beast. Great elk hunter. Like, just a stud of a guy. I really like Kenneth. So those three, it was cool that I had the 3 days with him. However, you know, Omar comes up with this idea, hey, we can go into the wilderness. I'll call Kenneth. He'll come out. And he told us to call him. I'm like, yeah, cool. Like, let's go make something happen, because this obviously isn't. Like, let's get away. Let's go truly backpack hunt the wilderness. Mm-hmm. He comes over and meets us. We got to meet with the fish and game agent. He's got to sign the resident, because Kenneth's the resident and he's taking me in. So we both have to sign this thing. It's like documented, make sure it's documented. And the whole time I'm just in the fish and game guy's ear. Like, this is the dumbest law. Do you realize? Like, our non-resident tags are what funds everything. Like, your guys' resident tags are so cheap. You guys already have so many benefit to the residents and the outfitters and all these things. It's like this non-resident money that's coming into the state. That's what's keeping the hunting alive in Wyoming. Like, which is cool. It's a really cool part about the state, but there's not enough residents to keep it like afloat. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? You have to have these non-residents coming in. Our tag prices are doubled now across the board, all these things. Every other state, every other place, everything, you can go into the wilderness. Everywhere, right? Alaska is different, but we'll talk about the lower 48. So I'm just in his ear constantly, and he kind of agreed with me. It's obviously not up to him at all, but I was gonna, anybody who was willing to listen to what I had to say, I was gonna say it to him. Kenneth agreed the whole time. So anyways, I'm in the wilderness and it's crickets in there. Like, it felt like we had the whole place to ourselves. We were in bulls all the time. Mm-hmm. It was fun. It was awesome. And then he had to leave because he was taking his girlfriend hunting, and then we had to leave the wilderness. So I lived that firsthand of like, this is so dumb. Because I have a big game tag in my pocket, I can't go in there. Mm-hmm. But if I was fishing, I could. If I was taking pictures, I could. If I was camping and just backpacking, I could. What's the difference?
Mm-hmm. I had to watch a 200-inch deer once and not be able to kill it because it was in the wilderness. And then it got killed later. And I'm like, I had him glassed up and everything, but I couldn't go kill him.
If you think about it logically, though, it is so crazy. That's such a crazy rule. Is it not?
It's what's crazy is like the boundaries are artificial. They're human made.
Yeah.
So it's not like, I mean, there's plenty of areas where, like, when I was in there last year, sheep hunting with my uncle, like, if grizzly bears are what we're talking about as the dangerous part, like, the only bear we saw was not in the wilderness, and where we knew there was a bunch of bears, also not in the wilderness.
Yeah.
So if the stated like goal is to keep people safe, you would need to reexamine that to make it like a, actually a pure reason.
I got an even better thing then. Make a non-resident who wants to go into the wilderness take a paid for course on bear safety. Mm-hmm. Another $20. Like I would pay that all day. I'm already into the States. It's already so expensive. If you're telling me I got to take a $100 bear safety online course to now like have a certificate to go in the wilderness, mm-hmm. you're going to make more money. The state will that way. And now I can go into the wilderness, which is where I want to be, backcountry hunting elk. That's definitely one I would want changed like immediately.
Yeah. And if it's like a resident can go in there, so that's just the same thing. It's not really a safety thing because a resident can go in without an outfitter, obviously, because they're residents.
Yeah.
But we as a non-resident
can't
go in there at all. But we can go fish, we can photo, we can hike.
Backpack, the whole thing.
Backpack.
You can overnight everything. In there.
Yeah.
Like, what's the difference?
We have a tag and it's dangerous now, and we can't go in there.
It's so crazy, man.
Yeah.
So that was my one.
I agree. That is my one for sure.
The other one I would want change, which hopefully it'll end up being changed everywhere, is the stupid corner crossing thing that we can't corner cross.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that needs to get. There's a lot in that with landowners.
Mm-hmm.
Like the locking up BLM. That's, come on.
Yeah, we're not.
You're giving the landowner way too much benefit. Like, yeah, he spent the money and has the land, but. You know, that was his choice. He did it. And I'm sure the landowner did it for whatever reason they wanted to, whether it's revenue producing or not, whether mm-hmm. it's protection of wealth and buying land or not. Who knows what it is? But to just, there's BLM wrapped up in the middle or like on this island in the middle of his private. That's his private now, essentially.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Like that, that should not be there. We need to figure something out with just land in general.
And like, road access as it pertains to going through places too.
Yes.
Because there's so much gray area. I think the data is really bad, is my impression, but there's so much gray area in the West around where, like, can I drive through this road?
Yeah. To access, is it a through access road or not?
What I think. Yeah. And I do think it's probably a complicated issue to solve, but what I would like to see reframed is, this is not a road going through private. It is a public domain that someone happens to own either side of.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much like, oh, it's private, 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 private. And then you see a parcel at the end. You're like, I would love to get there because we dealt with this last week. And it goes through like a residential area. Mm-hmm. And people can put signs up if they care to. It's their land. But you don't really have a great leg to stand on if it came down to it of like, can you go here or not?
Yeah.
Some of them have these like private road type of names, and on a map it'll say county road with this number. You're like, well, I hope our map is correct.
Yeah.
The data source didn't make it up.
Well, but, you know, too, the landowners we've all come across. I'm not saying all landowners are bad and do this, but we've all been there. They all put their fence up a little further than what it really is. They all say it's a private road when it's actually county maintained.
Mm-hmm.
Like they do those things, right? Because they bought the property and they want it protected, and I get that, but there has to be a two-way street on this kind of stuff where, like, look, there's a lot of benefit to owning land. There's a lot. Like you didn't buy it because it's going to decrease your life value, right? There's value, whether it's tax reasons or wealth protection or running cattle and making money, like whatever it is, there's a lot of benefit. There needs to be a two-way street on like keeping the public also, you know, it's a finite resource, right? So like there has to be a give and take of like the public as well being able to have through access when really there is, they can't put up a private road sign,
yeah.
Right? They can't extend their fence another couple hundred yards, whatever it is on where their line actually sits. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? We've all seen it. We've all dealt with it.
Yeah, there's so many places I've been to before in like Montana where you start on a county road. A county road goes off. It's all BLM right there. And all of a sudden it gets to one tiny, really skinny section of public on this road. And there's like signs everywhere you can't drive through it. And then the road continues through and goes through in more public. But there's so many signs right there that it's not.
Yeah.
And you try to dig into all the legalities about it. And then you have to like go through county stuff. And it's like, well, when did this road established back in the day to put that private piece there? And it's like, that's the legality part, but you have to dig through so much paper to try to get it, and it's impossible to get.
Yeah.
But they just think they own it, and it's like, me being who I am, I'm like, I'm obviously scared to go through there, so I don't.
Me too.
And I'm just pissed about that because I don't know if I can or cannot. And I've had people where I parked and some guy's coming through and some guy's like, hey, this is all private. Like, you know, you can't go in there. And I'm sitting over here like, well, I'm on the good side. Someone's coming through and someone else is yelling at someone else that they just drove through there.
Yeah.
And then they drive through there as well. Do they actually have permission too? Or are they just trying to be like all high and mighty and try to claim it themselves? And it's like so weird about like.
More so high and mighty trying to claim it for themselves has been my experience.
And it's like, there has to be some clarity there.
Yeah.
What's also interesting to me is like we, at this point, we are crystal clear on who owns what.
Yeah.
Beyond
the like that aspect of this is so dialed and has been forever and it's been digitized. How, but, and I get it. It's a hard problem to solve. These agencies, you know, don't have a bunch of money coming out of their ears. How do we not have the same with access on roads?
Yeah.
Like the road, like roads are, it is a different problem. It'll go from going through public land to going through private land. But like I said earlier, I think in the hierarchy of importance, we need to see it as this is a public domain.
Yes.
You happen to own both sides on either side of this, but this is like the most important public piece. You can't.
There has to be a way for the public to get back behind your piece. You can't lock the public out because you own all this frontage. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm talking about different. Are you talking about landlocked?
Both. Or, landlocked. Because I dealt with it in Wyoming too. It's like we had to drive way around. Logistically, it was crazy, but there was a through access road that it could have went just straight from the valley back into the forest, you know what I mean? Or like public land. But they essentially lock out a ton of people who don't have the vehicles or the setup to get back behind their private. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So I'm talking landlocked and just like frontage off a county road.
Yeah.
Like there's got to be a way for public to get back to public land.
Yeah, and when you, I guess the summation of the problem I'm describing is that I don't think anyone's like 100% clear. Game wardens, law enforcement, BLM, and Forest Service. I don't think anyone's 100% clear.
No.
So as a hunter, we're all trying to find our little secret spots and do things a little different. And it does make it pretty complicated.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, my brother even ran into a bunch of that once hunting Wyoming for deer. And like there were signs everywhere. It was a public road. And all of a sudden you hit a little section that like does get into a little bit of private on both sides, but it's a public road up to that point. And there's signs right there that say no public access beyond this point. Have any questions, call the game warden. So my brother called the game warden and like starts talking. He's like, yeah, you technically can't drive in there. And like doesn't make any sense. And then it goes back a little bit to public where you could probably park and then just hike on that public section. But now this public road becomes not public because there's just on both sides a private section.
Same thing happened to me in Wyoming. It's the exact same thing. So frustrating.
And like that was his whole plan to go back in there and just park a little bit further once he got back to public again and then go hike in, but he couldn't because all these signs say you can't access this road that was public the whole way up until this point.
Yeah.
And now it's not. But even just the corner crossing thing.
The karma thing, I've always told myself like I want to be a good, because I want to be a landowner, obviously, at some point. Mm-hmm. It's like, I want to be a good one, hoping like the karma's going to come. Yeah. Like, I would be like, yep, through access. Go. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to get back to the public, like, go through this piece. I don't, who cares? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Hopefully that karma comes around in the right way.
So, what's your regulation? Change.
Okay. Mine is, I would like to see all of the Western states require mandatory hunter reporting.
Yes. Ooh, I like that one too.
I think Nevada does it. I'm not sure what other states do it.
But, I like that one a lot.
But when you think of it, first of all, I'm not trying to go surveillance state on everyone. You could anonymize all this and just make it like, yep, you fill this out in your portal at the end of the year and you get a check mark or whatever. That means you can apply next year, whatever it is. It's not trying to steal spots or data from people. But I think we have so much changing at the moment with like weather patterns and all this type of stuff.
Human encroachment.
Human encroachment. There's a lot. I mean, hunting is, let's face it, it's different than it was 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of reasons. And so you have, wolves in Colorado, and you have deer numbers going down. You have elk numbers coming up in a lot of areas. And like, there's no way that biologists can do all this work by themselves.
Finger in the wind, judging the wind.
That's not a knock on them, but they have finite time, finite people, finite money. And what I think you could do is if you have enough licensed hunters reporting like what they saw and didn't see in like kind of broad areas. We're talking like counties or regions, not mountains. First of all, I believe in my heart a lot of people would tell the truth.
Well, that's what I was just going to say is the vast majority of hunters are just really good, moral, sound people.
Yeah.
We all want the better. We all want the better for this thing for as long as we can possibly keep it around for kids and grandkids and the next generation, all that stuff. The vast majority is bought into that mindset.
Yeah.
So yeah, we already self-police to be, everyone talks about how golfers are like the most moral. Dude, meet a hunter. Like, talk about self-policing. Mm-hmm. That's as most self-policing as you could ever get.
Yeah.
And we do it. So I agree. I think people would want to tell the truth and tell the truth to make it better.
Yeah. And when you think about the long-term effects of it, first of all, if people aren't telling the truth, you could use stats to like remove all the outliers. You could get a pretty good idea of what's going on, mm-hmm. but there's so many people in the field observing all the questions you would want to ask them. Are you seeing deer? Are you seeing elk? Are you seeing wolves? They call you on the phone and ask you this right now. And like, it's kind of annoying from the Montana perspective. They call you.
They might annoying. Call you.
They might call you, or they'll call you three times. And you're like wondering if you got your answer recorded three times or what. So, but anyway, when you ask those questions year over year over year, and you can give that to the biologist and they can ask their own questions and make their own inferences off this data, I think the it's so powerful because you just get so many more people out there. You get so much more observation. And I think there's just so much change that we're not ahead of right now.
Yeah.
You can track all sorts of trends in that data.
Yeah.
Montana doesn't even know how many deer they kill. They don't know how many elk they kill.
It's crazy to me. I really like this changed regulation. Do it like Nevada. You can't apply in the next year's draw until you fill out your survey.
And if you miss it, you get to pay a little fee. State makes some money. Exactly. Everything's online now.
Just do it through a portal.
I just did my Nevada one the other day. It takes 30 seconds. Did you hunt? Yes, no. Did you scout? Yes, no.
How many days did you hunt? I like, it makes me feel like the state cares. Like they care what I have to say. I actually appreciate it.
Nevada's awesome. They ask you, okay, if you're at an elk tag, how many points on the side? What's the length of the main beam? Yeah. Antelope? What's the horn length?
Data like, points.
How many horses did data you see?
Goes yeah, how many sheet. Wild horses did you see?
Yeah, how many?
Countless.
Feral horses, sorry.
Yeah, I just think you could get really, really good information from people and
make really good logical decisions on it too going forward. So just kind of finger in the wind, judging the miles per hour.
Yeah. And again, like I tip my hats to biologists and people that are trying to tackle this problem. It's just a huge problem to solve. And they're up against a lot of restriction, a lot of, people and budget constraints and all that. And I just think like hunters are observant people. You wouldn't be asking them the most brain buster questions of all time, but you could probably gather some really useful information that might, take certain things off their plate and allow them to focus on bigger things because we've made certain things easier or more reliable.
How many times do you get a phone call from someone you don't know that you don't answer?
All the time.
Yeah, you never answer.
Like literally, I never answer, so 99.9%.
Yeah.
And every time I've gotten random, the Montana survey thing, I don't answer because I don't know who this is and I miss it. And then you can't call them back. Mm-hmm. You can't just like, hey, just let me email you my thing and just be done with it. And the problem is too, like I have a big gripe of that state. I had the best tag in the state back in, was it 2014? There's like 40 freaking tags. You think they want to know if I kill or don't kill in like the best trophy unit?
Yeah.
I never got a phone call for the survey. Never.
That'd be
good data?
Yeah, that's
like,
wild.
Just ask me a little bit, like how the hunt went. Did I kill, did I not kill? Yeah. How many days was I out? Just to get some data on their best trophy unit that they make a lot of money on points for.
Yeah, that's wild to think about.
Yeah, just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Biologists would have a better time managing it. Hunters would enjoy seeing some of that data. Like, it's wild that we don't have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that change.
That would be great. I would agree with that.
What's yours, Lorenzo? It can be waterfall if you want.
Well, I said mine would be the just because I dealt with it and it's so fresh. I'm a fair weather fan here, just to be clear, because I jumped on yours when you said it. Now I'm jumping on I think for the overall good, Lane, that's a great one. What Lane brought up personally, because I just dealt with it, is Wyoming. That would be my regulation change. But the one I'm dealing with right now, not I shouldn't say dealing with, but the one that's just like frustrating and adds to the logistics is the 3-day limit of possession limit of waterfowl. Mm. And how that is, how it's like what counts and what doesn't. So if I shoot my 3-day limit, so 21 birds, and they're all breasted and in my freezer, I cannot shoot another bird unless I cook that and eat it or grind it, what's in my freezer. So like a breasted bird does not count as now it, that is still in the possession limit. Mm. What gets it out of the possession really? Limit is grinding it or cooking it and eating it. Mm. It's like when you're on the road, you're traveling, you got kids, you know, and you're shooting birds. It's good. It's like, man, what do you do? Right. Like, how do you, like, I'm not traveling with a grinder. So it's like, hey, quick barbecue. Let's, have some snacks real quick so we can shoot some more birds tomorrow.
And if you were traveling with a grinder, you would have solved absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Correct.
Like, you just changed this form of this breast to
it. But it gets me out of the possession limit.
I know, but it's
yeah. It's just weird. It's like a really weird, and I don't have an answer for it because it is, this one's tough too, right? Because they're federally protected migratory birds, a lot of different species, and each species counts against the bag limit. But then there's like species specific limits, you know, on scop and pintail and, you know, two-hin mallards, all these like species specific. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be able to identify what the breast is, you know, all this stuff. But it's like, think about if, you know, your possession limit of a big game animal, it doesn't count if it's, if you take it to the butcher and it's in your freezer, like you're still in possession of one animal. So the only way to not be in possession of that animal anymore to go on your next hunt is grind it or eat it. Mm. Like it's difficult to do that before your next hunt. Like think about if you guys had to do that. You know what I mean? On a big game animal. So it's just
it's, a moose.
Yeah. Dude, it's tough, man. It really is.
Do you think they do that to keep people from like shooting a limit and then going out in the evening or something like that? Like, is it because people act in bad faith otherwise?
I mean, all laws are, I think, because of that. So yes, like it's all the bad faith actors. But again, I mean, hunters are not all, but the vast majority are just good moral people. Right. Like we know we believe in karma. We believe in the hunting gods. Like you're not going to set yourself up for bad luck in the future. It's kind of how we all think.
Yeah.
It's hard, man. It's like really difficult because it's been a good season so far and I've hunted a lot of days and it's like, okay, who's got a grinder? Who's cooking these things up? Yeah. We got to, you know, we need to make sure we're not over the limit. It's difficult.
And if you're hunting with like three people, that's a lot of duck to be putting down.
And I am hunting with, you know, 2 to 4 people on every hunt. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It just gets frustrating. Like logistically really frustrating.
Yeah. And then you're traveling too. So you're going from different states and that complicates things.
And then like the drive time to the next state, you know, the next spot, you pulling over on the campground and just little coal rolling and fire up some duck, you know, some duck treats real quick so you can go shoot some more. Just, it gets frustrating.
Yeah.
And if you have them just sitting in your freezer breasted, like you are over the limit. So you have to do something with them. You can't just like stockpile it throughout the season. And then in the off season, decide what you want to do with it. Like, oh, let's have a duck night with the family. Let's grind some. Let's, you know, have some people over. You don't have that freedom because it's like you either got to grind it now or cook it now to then go shoot more birds.
Yeah, so it makes it pretty rare to be like, hey, it's August. I'm going to cook up some, or let's say like June when there's really nothing going on. And like, I want to cook some duck up. Most likely you probably already
eaten it by now. The most I could have in my freezer is 21 because my wife, I mean, I could buy her a license and I don't know if that counts or not because she's not killing them. I am, but I don't know. But let's just, I'm the only one in my household that's shooting ducks right now with a stamp, a federal stamp, a hunting license, all that stuff. If I wanted to have people over in June to do a duck cook, the most I could have in my freezer is 21.
And most likely you've already eaten it by then.
And mostly, yeah. I mean, because I've had to. I can't have more than 3 days on. Isn't that frustrating?
That is frustrating. But one of the solutions that I've been asking for from you is that we can have a duck breast cook-off in the Go Hunt office.
I mean,
which I will be winning.
If you guys are going to help me out, I'm all for it.
I took second in the jerky contest. I plan on winning the duck breast thing, and I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I already have my plan.
Let's do it. It'll help me out.
Okay.
think Omar will just chat GPT something?
Because I've got like, can't remember how many I have left in my freezer, but like, let's call it 12, 11 maybe, duck breasts in there. And I need to get that gone before this next trip.
Let's do it.
I need to eat it before this next trip. Or grind it. You got a grinder.
I do.
Duck burgers.
Duck burgers. Let's do it.
I don't think I've ever had a duck burger.
We should do that.
You see where I'm coming from on this one?
Yes. That's difficult. That is difficult.
Yeah.
Especially because it's a 120-day season.
Yeah.
Like your entire nutrition plan has to center around ducks if you're going to be like a pretty serious
every
duck
3 days. It's like every 3 days on hunting days, every three hunting days you have, you got to bank in a grind day or a cook day.
That's why it's got to get a grill in the blind and start cooking.
Or we could do that before just right when they're rolling in from
That's
the
also
dog.
A good idea.
Don't even let the meat settle.
That is also a good idea.
That'd be a nice one to figure out a different rule on that one.
Yeah.
Rutting bucks next week.
Yes.
Going out. Any buck? What are you looking for?
Okay. Let me just back up a step because I was going to say my other regulation change that's never going to happen. It's not even, I'm not enforceable. And I'm not trying to act like I'm better than anyone with this regulation change.
Oh, yes, you are.
No.
I'm just kidding.
But at some point, we have to draw the line on shooting four-corn deer from the road. But for most people. And I get there's big four corns. I get that. I'm not saying antler restrictions, but I would like to see like reasonably immature deer not getting killed.
Not getting killed.
Well, yeah. This is one. I'm not a fan of horn restrictions.
Unless you're like genuinely killing it for the meat, totally cool. But if you're just going to go out and smoke one from the road to say you filled your tag, I think we need to have some like standard that's not enforceable, but an age limit or something would help the population, in my opinion, would help the quality of hunting.
I'm not a fan of horn restriction. It doesn't work.
It doesn't
work. Literally doesn't work. However, if somebody can't tell a mature breeding aged 2-point compared to a yearling 2-point, you probably need to go take a class again.
Yes.
Yeah. Like that's a pretty easy one to tell the difference in. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
a matured age 2-point is a wildly different deer than a yearling forked horn.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's one. I don't know. I guess the hunters could like band together and decide, hey, man, we're letting all immature 2-points roll.
It's more of a tough one. It's more of like a food for thought type of thing than it's not enforceable. That would never happen. But I would like to see that, especially. Like where it feels like we're in a little downturn in the last 4 or 5 years, especially in eastern Montana, where you just don't see the deer you used to. So that would be an interesting one. But as far as next week goes, Brady, I would just like to shoot one that I think is mature aged. I don't think I'm going to have like all the time in the world to get after it. So I'd like to just shoot something that gets me excited and probably not overthink it from there.
What gets you excited?
What gets me excited?
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to think it's like reaching maturity. Well, like I'm not going to put a score on it.
No score, but more in detail. Like what gets me excited? Mass and like gnarly.
Yeah.
Like I love mass.
I
love eye guards. I love mass.
I do too. Chocolate antlers get me excited.
Yeah.
And that's just what you're going to find out there.
Yeah.
Those Eastern Montana bucks, they're cool, but they're kind of sand colored, but you get something like these colors.
That's where that's awesome. The whole score thing, like it's for whatever reason is in the driver's seat on 99% of people when they talk about deer.
Yeah.
Like who gives a shit? What does it look like? Is it just gnarly heavy?
Exactly.
Like I'd way, way rather shoot a gnarly, heavy, narrow, tall 160 buck than a thin horned, wide, no mass, no eye guard, 180 buck. Like I genuinely would. I'm not just saying that to say it. Like I genuinely would rather kill just a gnarly, even shallow fork, but if he's carrying mass all the way up and he's got pipes going up and he's only got 4-inch fronts, but
he's got one eye.
Yeah,
he's
one eye
a little bit.
And his front forks look like they're just massive, like massy. I would way rather shoot that.
Yeah.
That's what gets me going is mass and like tall. I don't really care about width. I don't really care about like fork depth or any of that stuff. I want mass and tall.
Yeah, and if you can look at a deer and say to yourself, like, this thing probably holds its own versus the other ones up
here.
Yeah,
that's
like
the
other that's where
big old swole neck, one gray eye. It's like, oh, dude, that's my guy.
Some stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what gets me going. So that'd be cool. That'd be the goal.
Best of luck to you.
Like your 3-point you killed. That gets me going.
The one in my office.
Yeah,
yeah.
Carries mass all the way to the top.
Yeah, and like that, it's not the biggest deer ever, but he is there's probably not many bigger ones where he was at.
He gets that deer gets me.
Yeah.
Dark horned.
Yeah.
Heavy. Yeah, I like that.
Yep. So I think you got to chase the feeling.
Chase the feeling. That's what I would say too.
It's kind of a
right place, right time. And like the environment, is it snowing? Is it nasty out? Yeah, that's a good deer.
You guys are being honest with yourself too, because I don't want to lead the witness, but. Like the set and setting affects me too.
Yeah.
Like if I got a buck that, or an elk for that matter, but it's just like that perfect lighting and he's doing all the things that I like about what they do. And he's standing on the hillside in the right, right position, turning his head around.
Lip curling.
And I'm like, that'll get me going more so than like just the animal itself.
You just
I'm
get
like
that
this
feeling.
Setting. Ooh.
Yeah.
This moment, like the moment will put me in it.
That'll
too.
Talk you into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice and cold out.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. I like it. Well, I'm jealous you got a late season deer tag.
Me too.
Yeah.
But I'll be shooting ducks, so don't worry.
Brady and I are going out for cow elk later this year if we can get the tags. So the season is still young.
I hope so. But I definitely hope we can pick up a cow elk tag.
Yeah.
I need some meat in my freezer. Eventually, I'm gonna run out of mountain lion bear.
You need some ducks.
But I think it was a good podcast. Yeah. Anyone else going out to hunt? I'm jealous. Hope they have a good time.
Omar popped his head in here and asked us to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving because I think that's when this podcast is coming out.
Yep,
so.
It's coming out Thanksgiving Day, I believe. Yes.
Yeah. A Merry Thanksgiving is what he said.
Merry Thanksgiving.
He did say Merry Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Omar.
Sounds like something Omar would say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got anything else before we wrap up?
No,
awkward silence.
I don't think so.
Okay.
It's been an amazing year.
If it has been a fun
this
year.
Is probably my last appearance of 2025, my second and my last appearance of 2025. So this is my opportunity to thank everyone for making it an amazing year.
I think we got another chance to get you back.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I wasn't fishing for an invite. I was just
I mean, you're going on a hunt.
The data would say.
We're going to want to hear about it.
Yeah. The data would say I come on once a year, maybe twice.
The data would say you're going on a hunt and we want to recap.
Yep.
Okay.
So I would say you're back on.
We can do that. Brady, do you have news to share on the podcast perspective?
He did last podcast.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. They shared that I'm coming out with the podcast.
Oh, by the way, I committed to something, actually.
What?
We put in a request to throw names in the comments.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it
was for Brady's podcast.
Yeah. And it was literally just right off the top of my head. And I said, if we do end up picking one of those, we'll do something to make it worth their time.
Nice.
I don't know what it is yet because it was in the moment, but.
Did you guys go?
I committed to that.
We did not leak. We did not leak any of the front running
names.
We didn't
leak anything.
It's a 3-horse race at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. But who knows? Dude, somebody could come out.
Someone will come out with an amazing one.
Yeah. And if we use it, we'll make it well worth the effort.
Yes. So just to restate, the funniest or best name for Brady's podcast. I've put in one serious and one joking one, which we can talk about later, but
we'll talk about when they all roll in and we decide.
The funny one though totally contradicts what you just said like 30 a minute ago.
Yeah, it does. Let's keep that one a secret for now.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm excited for that.
Yeah. Good luck next week. I'm
Thank
jealous,
you.
Like I said.
Thank
I hope
you.
I get some texts and good news.
Should be fun. Fresh off a Grizz W.
When do you leave?
Saturday.
Nice.
Drive up Saturday. Hunt next week. Do a little Thanksgiving.
Enjoy it.
Thank you. All Appreciate right. it, guys.
See
We're
you.
We're out.